Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
So it's my absolute pleasure here to welcome Shinzen Young here to speak to us today. So just for everyone, just to start off with, this isn't a Zoom webinar, so if you're afraid why you can't see yourself, that's the reason why. So this talk and all the others will be available 48 hours afterwards, and if you were wanting to do so, you could also upgrade to something. Now, Shinzen Young today is going to be talking to us on enlightenment, East and West, an invitation to embodied spirituality. So Shinzen himself is an author, a mindfulness teacher, a neuroscience research consultant. He's based out of the US and he categorizes, adopts, and teaches mindfulness. He's worked with unified mindfulness as well as doing his own staff consulting collaborations with Harvard Medical School, Carnegie Mellon University, the University of Vermont, and a whole heap of other stuff. Today it's an absolute pleasure. I'm really looking forward to this because I asked him, hey, can we do something where we look at all the different traditions, and that's what we're going to be doing. So providing a clear comprehensive paradigm with all the meditation practices and comparing various forms, looking at similarities, differences and strengths and weaknesses. So Shinzen, great to have you here. Thanks.
Happy to be here. So are we going to have me talk a bit and then have me interact with people, or is it just a straight up presentation?
So it's quite nice to have a little bit of interaction here with people if you want, so I can facilitate the questions and answers with that.
That would be great. I mostly like the Q&A aspect of things, so I'll talk as much as I need to, a little bit, and then maybe we can open it up and interact with people. My current job is as a research scientist at the University of Arizona. I have a laboratory here that I co-direct with Dr. Jay Sanguinetti, who is a specialist in cognitive neuroscience, and I'm sort of a specialist on the contemplative experience, and we work together to see if we can come up with an interaction between the best of the future, which I believe is science, and the best of the past, which I believe is contemplative experience. And this is broadly all over the world, I would say. Can these worlds, the world of science and the world of contemplative experience, come together in a way where it's a good marriage? A good marriage produces something. Maybe it's kids, maybe it's just a good life, but a good marriage produces something. And we wonder if there's a possible good marriage between these two worlds. If there is, we often see that when we get a hybrid marriage, mixed races, mixed worlds sharing their best, something magic happens. We get a Wunderkind or some sort of wonder child that is of benefit to humanity dramatically and unexpectedly. So that's what we're hoping for. But in order for the world of science and the world of contemplative experience to come together, we have to bring the spirit of science into the way that we talk about contemplative experience. And also, it's highly desirable that the scientists themselves should not be armchair scholars, but the scientists themselves should have at least some experience with a contemplative or meditative practice. So that causes a basis for sharing. We bring the spirit of science into the way we talk about contemplation, and we bring, we ask the people that are doing the scientific research on the contemplation to actually experience contemplation. And then we let time pass and we see if we can come up with something really new, something that no one has seen before, that harvests and does so in a way that's not merely intriguing or entertaining, but actually industrial strength changes the course of human history for the better in this century, or certainly by next century. So it's a very big picture endeavor. So the reason I mentioned this is I'm going to be talking about, we could call it meditation, contemplation, mindfulness. For me, these are all pretty synonymous. People can make distinctions, but the terms are pretty fluid in the English language at this point. So let's just embrace that and say things like meditation, mindfulness, contemplation. We're going to talk about them using the spirit of science. Now, if you are, and we're doing that because this will aid the communication between the worlds. So if you are a scientist, you're familiar with what it sounds like when we bring the spirit of science to bear on a subject. But if you're not a scientist, you won't be familiar with that. And my way of presenting things might seem strange to you. It might seem different from what you would expect from someone who is doing a workshop on in a program called meditation and breath work. You may hear me talking in a different way, and this can give a different slant on things. Now, I remember failing all my math and science courses in school, every single one of them. You can check my high school and even middle school, although we called it junior high back then in the US. You can check my record. You can also check my record at university. I failed anything that had to do with math and science. So why am I even talking about these subjects? Well, at some point in my life, I realized that there was a possibility for the best of the East to cross-fertilize with the best of the West, and that I needed to get good at science. And I used my meditation techniques to overcome my strong beliefs that I was incapable of working in this area, of understanding this. So because I'm actually intrinsically bad at math and science, genetically, just in every way, I just failed. If I got good at it, then I must have had to figure out some stuff. And I did, stuff they don't tell you, but I wish they would. So if you had any trouble with science or math, it's probably for the same reason. They didn't tell you certain things that, and by they, I mean your teachers. They didn't tell you what you needed to know to approach the subject. And so when it seems strange, then you just gave up. That's what happened to me. So I'm going to slip you one of the secrets. The spirit of science involves being extremely careful about language. And at the beginning, you wonder, why do they talk about it this way? Why do they define it that way? That seems unnatural. That seems vague. That seems very complicated. That seems irrelevant. You can't see where it's all going. But centuries and centuries of people have thought these things through. And if you're patient, you come to realize, oh, that's why they said it that way. There was a plan down the line. In order to understand Y and Z, you have to understand P and Q now, even though you can't see the relationship between P and Q. But down the line, P, Q, and X, Y, and Z are going to all come together for you. And you will go, oh my God, that is very clear. I'm glad I was patient enough to stay with it. So I had to figure that out on my own. But once I did, science and math became quite easy, and they will for you also if you're interested. Anyway, that's by way of a preamble. Let's talk about contemplative experience. Well, we said we were going to be precise about words. So actually, I think before we do that, we should bring some precision to what we mean by embodiment. I hear people using that word in different ways, actually quite a wide range of ways. And that makes sense. People have different understandings. People have different agendas. There's no right or wrong, but it is useful to maybe get an idea of some of the ways that people might use the word embodiment. And then having done that, we can be clearer about how contemplative experience might relate to the concept of embodiment. So first, I'm going to suggest that broadly, looking over the whole world, one way to think about the ways in which people are using the word embodiment is the following four. There is a sort of positive way of thinking about embodiment in that embodiment is a way of being with your body that is desirable. That's one way we can think about what that word could mean. a way of being with your body that is desirable, is embodiment. Another way to think about it is sort of negative. There's something called lacking embodiment, and that's bad. And embodiment is not being not embodied. It's avoiding that thing. And often that thing, people that talk about embodiment this way, often the thing that they're talking about is thought or the mind. Just get out of your head and get into your body. That's a way of talking about embodiment. It's basically saying there's something wrong. There's a wrong way to be in your head. And we're going to cure that by having you focus on your body. Or the wrong way of relating to your thoughts prevents you from being embodied. So another way to think about it. So there's a good way to be with your body. We'll call that embodiment. Getting lost in your thoughts or some other thing is the opposite of embodiment. That's not good. Embodiment is not doing that. Then there's what I call the surface way to talk about embodiment. And the reason that there's a surface way is because whenever anything is important or spoken of publicly, is a meme, is a theme in a human culture, anything. What I'm about to say is not just true of embodiment, it's true of anything that people talk about. I'm going to define the superficial understanding of embodiment. That sounds pejorative, but it's not. It just means this is the way people think about things that are looked upon as positives. Embodiment is a positive. It's talked about that way. Whenever a society has something that many people are talking about as a positive, could be anything, you're going to have superficial understanding. Superficial understanding has two characteristics. V and V, the letters V. It's vague and it's valenced. There's a something out there called in embodiment. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I do know it's a good thing. And not having it is a bad thing. But I can't quite pin it down, but it has something to do with the body, obviously. Something to do with being present or aware in some, I don't know. And it's a good thing though, that I do know. And not being embodied is a bad thing, that I do know. So I have strong opinions, but which is the V of valence, I like, I dislike. But I don't, but there's also a sort of vagueness. I couldn't just sit down and say, here's the story of embodiment. Embodiment means this, X, Y, Z. By X, I mean this. By Y, I mean this. I mean, by Z, I mean this. Now, X is used this way in ordinary English, but here in this context, within our context, X is going to mean something a little different. Furthermore, you might confuse Z with a concept that's used in this other area. It's similar, but Okay, so you see where this is going. You're not vague at all. You're able to tell the story of embodiment as you understand it. So not being able to do that, that's what I hear out there in the form of, I call it the superficial. Now, this, to repeat, has absolutely nothing to do specifically with embodiment. It's true of anything. My area is mindfulness. Mindfulness is a huge fad. Lots of people have a vague sense of what it is. It's supposed to be a good thing. But they, if you ask them to define it, pin it down, they probably can't do that. They'll tell you it has something vaguely to do with being aware, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So in my own field, superficial understanding is quite common. The other field that I'm in is science. Same thing. It's popular. People talk about it, but there's often a lot of vagueness and valence, particularly if it's science that affects them, climate, theories that seem to contradict scriptures. These are areas where people have skin in the game. So the discussion becomes vague and valenced. So I said there's four ways that people talk about embodiment. One is sort of, hey, it's a way of being with the body that's good. Another is being lost in your thoughts, or being non-embodied is bad. That's a bad way to be with your mind, but we can show you something else. Another is, you sort of know it's a good thing, but you couldn't really give a science-informed discussion of it. And now let's talk about a fourth way that we hear people talk about embodiment, which actually does not necessarily reference body at all. It's a way of being present or fully inhabiting what you say and how you move and how you feel. It's fully experiencing everything that you see and hear on the outside. Physical sight, physical sound, and everything you see and hear on the inside. Mental image, mental talk. Oh, by the way, that's your mind, isn't it? So if we think of embodiment from this fourth point of view, then phrases like presence or aliveness might come to mind. And those would be good phrases, but they don't quite fulfill the needs of science. We can understand them humanly, but I can't really quite go into the lab and try to measure biophysically presence or aliveness yet. Yet. science is not up to that yet. But I can see how science could be up to that. If we decide to talk about presence or aliveness, informed by the spirit of science. So I gave you a little preamble, a little warning that the spirit of science way of approaching things might initially seem counterintuitive and irrelevant. But down the line, you realize, oh, they needed all of that to sort of create the situation where the big picture gels and we see it. Excuse me. So something extraordinary happened in the 1980s in the US. An acquaintance of mine named Jon Kabat-Zinn, who at the time was a molecular biologist working in a hospital, was asked by doctors to help pain patients with a practice that John had picked up in Asia called mindfulness. So this is 1980s, 40 years ago. The world has changed incredibly because of that. He did it and it worked. People with pain, he gave them practices that involved observing the discomfort, but in a state that we call equanimity, and deconstructing the discomfort, dividing it into what part is mental image, what part is mental talk, what part is physical in the body, what part is emotional in the body, what part is stable, what part is currently fluid, what's dense, is there anything spacious? He had people do attentional exercises. And these were people that with pain issues that the doctors were unable to deal with medications or treatment. And it sort of worked amazingly. This weird practice, technically called satipatthana, or the foundation of mindfulness from Burma, of all places, straight from Rangoon to Boston. And it worked in a clinical setting. Well, John's a scientist, so he knows what you gotta do. You gotta do clinical, you gotta jump through the hoops of clinical science to really prove that it works. And that became something called MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. And that opened the floodgate, along with one other thing. The Mind and Life Institute, which has somewhat changed its character now, as far as I can see. But back then, it was a mission to train neuroscientists to have a meditation practice. So they were doing that, but they were also having senior contemplatives, famous meditation figures, famous Buddhist figures, dialoguing with famous scientists. And the combination of John's work and Adam Engel with MBSR back in those days, that opened the floodgate for this science spirituality interface. So, John did a lot of important work in validating the clinical effect of mindfulness, or at least beginning to that process. But what there wasn't time for, because it all just happened very quickly and quite amazingly, there wasn't time to really spend the 2 decades needed to ask basic scientific questions. Usually, if a field is going to take off, some people have spent 10, 20, 30 years just thinking about the theory, just and the language and the mathematical formalism that we're going to use and so forth. They just think about it and think about it and think about it until they get an idea that then takes off. But here the idea took off before anyone had a chance to do any of this other stuff. So my job is to do the other stuff. And that's, so that's what I'm going to talk to you about. And then we will have time for some Q&A. So from a scientific point of view, we have to be quite impartial about things. So all over the world, there are people that meditate. And some of those people are adepts. They've been meditating for decades and decades and decades. Presumably, those adepts, those long-term practitioners, have very deep and important experiences. Problem is, they come from different traditions. So they are going to describe those experiences perhaps in very different ways. Some of them are going to say, I realized my true self. Some are going to say, I realized I truly have no self. Some are going to say, I found the essence of what love is. Some are going to say, I discovered that I am a soulless robot that has no free will whatsoever. Some are going to talk about energy. Some are going to talk about tranquility. Oh my God, from a scientific point of view, what are we going to do with this? Because this, there's just no place to drive a wedge in here. The formulations, the descriptions are very, very different. So then, as a scientist, we ask ourselves, okay, but do they have something in common? And by they, I mean East, West, ancient, and modern. There's a Judeo-Christian tradition of practice. It includes Islam. It's an Abrahamic tradition. There's a pre-Christian, pre-Islamic Western way of meditating that existed in the Greco-Roman era. There are, of course, the practices that come out of India, and there are the practices that come out of China. That's East-West. But then there's ancient and modern. There's what our shamanic ancestors practiced and experienced, still preserved in some places. One of the U.S., I know this is an international program, so I'll say U.S. is a young country, But we actually still, right down the street, literally a few miles, which way? Let's see. A few miles that way. I have a Native American friend who has a sweat lodge on the reservation, right in his backyard. When I go visit him and we do a sweat lodge ceremony, he's a sun dancer, he's a pipe carrier, he's a native speaker of his own language. I enter a time warp, I go back 40,000 years. Everything disappears. We're back in the old Stone Age and experiencing their version of contemplative practice. So, and then we have MBSR and Unified Mindfulness, my system. These are modern things. So when I talk about East, West, ancient, modern, there's a big spectrum. So from a scientific point of view, how can we unify all of this? Well, they all have a few things in common. When you look carefully, you'll see that every contemplative tradition, hold on for just a second. Sorry, I have to interrupt.
Hey guys, I would encourage just at this point in the talk, if you do need to sort of move or stretch slightly, if you find yourself drawn into the screen, feel free to sort of soften your eyes. If you can do that, just expand out peripherally, have a little wriggle, notice your breathing, and if you can just get yourself a little bit more present as we're here. You may even type in the chat how this is going for you, or if there's anything.
Sorry about that. I had an intrusion. So what do they all have in common? If we can see that, then we will begin to have a unified view of world contemplative practice. Also, if we are interested in the notion of embodiment, then if we are talking about embodiment in that broader sense of how present you are to your senses and how alive you are in your actions, if that broader meaning of embodiment is our meaning, then that pretty much aligns with what happens when you're successful with contemplative practice. So if we look around the world, you'll see that each of the contemplative traditions can be viewed from a certain point of view. In science, we're usually interested in what are the basic dimensions or atoms or primes out of which a complex phenomenon is woven. So we can do a dimensional analysis on contemplative practice. Once again, worldwide, East, West, ancient, modern. If we look at adepts, experienced practitioners, you will find that they have three forms of focus power. They may have, usually they came to that as the result of systematic practice. Sometimes it happens spontaneously, but usually people work hard. So those three core contemplative skills that allow you to be present, embodied in that sense, are concentration power, sensory clarity, and equanimity. We're going to say that these are technical terms. (Clears throat) meaning I'm going to define them carefully. You can think of concentration power as the ability to focus on what you want to focus on. Clearly, that is a very useful ability for a human being. Turns out that most people don't have much of that ability. Turns out that that ability can be vastly improved by systematic training. The systematic training is called mindfulness or meditation or contemplation. A lot of you have built up your body. Maybe you got twice as strong. I don't know how much stronger your body can get, but I can assure you that relative to the way most people can concentrate, you can increase your concentration power by a factor of 10. And that's base level concentration. That's how concentrated you are in daily life when you're not particularly trying to be concentrated. It's like strength. Strength is there after you develop it. It's not just there in the gym. Focus strength, contemplative strength, meditation strength, same thing. It's there with you all day. So you can be 10 times, you can have 10 times the ability to focus on what you deem relevant. Notice I didn't say focus narrow or broad. I just said focus on what's relevant. You can see here, feel your drive to work in a state of profound focus, and you're driving safely because you're focusing on all and only what you need to drive the car. But you are focusing in a tasted zone or state of high concentration that you're enjoying for its intrinsic focus reward. Concentration power, that's dimension one. Dimension two, sensory clarity. At any given instant, your inner world could have mental image, mental talk, body emotion. Your outer world could have physical sight, physical sound, physical impact, touch. If those tangle together, you've got a muddle. But if you elevate your base level of sensory clarity, those elements interpenetrate without interfering. The world becomes richer and richer. You can elevate your resolution power and detection power of all your sensory sensors dramatically. Elevate base level. It's with you in daily life all the time, even when you're not particularly trying to be sensorially clear. You are. Sensory clarity, that's an element that's always there, or should always be there. I corrected myself. Equanimity, the hardest one to understand. You can think of it as a radical version of a radical version of letting go of being self-conflicted. Radical means go to the root, radicalis in Latin. So a very deep version of what on the surface people talk about all the time, which is learning how to reduce inner conflict. We all know about that. We all know that sometimes we push and pull on ourselves in a way that isn't productive and is uncomfortable. We know about that kind of situation where the system is grinding against the system. on the surface. But what people don't realize is that subtly, in the subconscious, deep, deep in the subconscious, excuse me, there's subtle self-interference going on all the time. So deep equanimity is when the subconscious circuits stop interfering with themselves. This reduces suffering, causes pain to not hurt as much, but it also leads to a profound integration of the person, because it's really subtle is significant. It's that subtle, dusty coagulation deep down that causes a lot of the problems. Fortunately, we can train people into non-self interference. Actually, we don't train people into it. We show people how to train their sensory circuits into non-self interference. The circuits don't interfere with themselves anymore. And that creates a sense of the surface self being integrated, and that brings that aliveness. So, or is associated with of that aliveness that I mentioned. This is the top page executive summary version. Look around the world, look at the people who are teaching embodiment in this, in a deep, broad sense, and with clear definitions. Look to what people are doing with meditation, contemplation, mindfulness. You'll be able to analyze what's working there. If you wish, it's only one way to think about things, but if you were to so desire, you could use concentration, clarity, and equanimity as a axial or dimensional analytic tool to understand both your own practice and the various traditions of the world. Now, I know this is a huge data dump that I just delivered. Lots of ideas there. I will say that every single idea I have given you is documented and explained with videos and free articles that sit all over the internet. So you will have no trouble whatsoever finding out the details and getting training in this if you so desire. It's, you know, it's two or three clicks away. Sorry, I talked a little longer than I thought I would, but I guess I had more to say, which is probably a good thing. How much time do we have for Q&A?
We have exactly 70 seconds.
Oh, we're done. Well, then we don't have any time for Q&A. Sorry about that. Maybe next time.
Yeah, well, good. Thank you, Shinzen. It was certainly what I was asking for. So it was quite nice to have you here and get that from you. I've just shared your website there, shinzen.org as well, which I know, as you said, has a ton of free resources there.
Yeah, that's, and also unifiedmindfulness.com. Yeah.
And unifiedmindfulness is where people...
That has other stuff, yeah. So sorry, folks, I really did intend to do the Q&A, but sometimes I've got something in my belly that I need to say, and that was it. Thanks for who you are and who you are becoming.
Thank you, Shinzen. I'm going to let you have the final word in a second. Now, that was a nice final word. Now I'll let you have another final word. But just before that, I want to say, everyone, if after this session you want to have a chat to each other to really integrate it, because I know Shinzen's really big on how you can actually integrate some of the insights from meditation into life. So one of those ways might be to have a chat with some other people. So we've got coffee break rooms. We can go in and talk to some other people after this session. So I've linked that there. Or you can also do the same on the Facebook group. So the Facebook group is also in the chat there. And the discussion, talk about cool resources you find, all that sort of stuff. It's really nice to do. And as I just shared there, I'll share again Shinzen's website, shinzen.org, for anyone who's watching this, not in the Zoom room. Or you can also go to unifiedmindfulness.com and find some more information on all of this. I've done a few courses on there, and they're rather lovely. So thanks for that. And finally, if you would like to get these recordings, because apparently we can't be in 10 places at the same time to watch 10 different channels on the Embodiment Conference, you can upgrade and get this talk, own the library to digest it in your own time and have it forevermore. So we appreciate it as a thank you to us, and it also enables, cost about $1 million to put on this conference, so it enables everyone else to access it for free if you were to buy that. And the keynote channels are in 9 languages as well, which is quite nice. So it's accessible to everyone. And final word then, Shinzen, what's your top tip on how to be more embodied?
There's an old joke. It's a US joke, but I'll tell it anyway. So in New York City, someone is lost in New York City, and they ask, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? So Carnegie Hall was where the greatest musicians of the world would perform, probably still the case. So they're asking, you know, how do I get on the subway, or what street do I take in order to go to the most important, or one of the most important concert halls in the world? How do I get to Carnegie Hall? How do I get to where the concert is? So the way you get to the concert, the way you're able to play the concert or appreciate the concert. So the joke goes, so the question is, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? The answer, practice, practice, practice. There's a concert to be offered to the world. It's called our life. But we actually have to do some etudes, some play some scales if we want to optimize our performance. So my final word is practice, practice, practice.
On that, Nate, thank you, Shinzen. Enjoy the rest of your day, and everyone else. We'll see you back here in an hour, if you would like, for Mary McHenry's talk, looking at how we can maintain awareness and mindfulness on screens. So there's another integration into what we're doing. So thanks, Shinzen. I really appreciate it. Cheers.
Bye-bye, everyone. Have a good one.